Hello, everybody. Welcome to Insights Now from JP Morgan Asset Management. I'm Brendan Hall, and I'm a research analyst on the Market Insights team, and we have a great episode lined up for you today. Joining me across the table is my good friend, Jack Manley. He's a global market strategist on the Market Insights team and the person that we on the team turn to when the conversation shifts towards crypto. And that is exactly where we're headed today. If I'm being honest, this is one of the parts of the market where I'm still very much a student. And that's what actually makes this conversation all the much more exciting. We are going to dive deeper into Bitcoin, how the crypto landscape has evolved over the last few years, and maybe most importantly, how investors should think about this asset class right now and allocating to it in portfolios. So without further ado, Jack, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brandon. I'm really excited about this.
Me too. So let's just dive right in. We'll think about the cryptocurrency universe. It's about $2.3, $2.4 trillion today. But I think it's important to recognize that Bitcoin makes up about 60% of that, roughly.
Yeah.
So to kick us off, why is it that when people think about cryptocurrency, they instantly think about Bitcoin? And why have people grown so excited and so obsessed with the asset today?
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that whenever I have conversations with clients about crypto, there is a real tendency, and I mean, I do it too, I kind of slip into it too, to exchange those terms, right? When I say crypto, I mean Bitcoin. When I mean Bitcoin, or when I say Bitcoin, I mean crypto. It's almost like, you know, how people call like facial tissues Kleenexes, like, you know, the brand name that everybody associates with what is essentially a commodity. That's very much how Bitcoin functions in the world of crypto. It is sort of a stand-in for the broader crypto universe. Now, why that's the case, I mean, some of it has to do with what you mentioned, right? It represents, depending on the day, anywhere from like 50 to 70% of crypto market capitalization. So it is by far the biggest crypto token out there. Bitcoin is also the original crypto token out there. It's been around, I think, since probably 2009, I believe is what you had dug up in your research. It's been around for a while, right? Well over 15 years at this point. It is the original. There wasn't anything else like it for a very long time. And a token like that, I think has real like first mover advantage, right? The fact that it was the only crypto token for, I mean, the better part of a decade means that for a while it was synonymous with the concept of cryptocurrency. So that's part of it too. And then when you think about the kind of price dynamics that you've seen in Bitcoin, like over the, I don't know, I mean, let's say over the last 15 years, really, since it first started, the fact that it has been so volatile, the fact that you can like turn on CNBC and scrolling on the bottom on the Chiron is like the price of Bitcoin that day. And it's always up 15% or down 20%. It's never small, minute, you know, easy moves like what you see in, say, the equity market. I think it has this capacity to really hold our attention. And so the combination of all those things, I would say, is why, you know, Bitcoin has kind of become the king of crypto. Now, what's the appeal of like Bitcoin, and why are people so like fanatical about this thing? And when I think about what makes Bitcoin so appealing to somebody that may want to hold it, there are a few things. The first thing we have to do is consider that Bitcoin really aims to be something like a digital version of cash, right? Like cryptocurrency, we say that, we don't necessarily think about it. Currency is in that word, right? This thing is supposed to be a currency. It's supposed to function like the dollar or the euro or the yen or whatever. And in that role as a currency, a lot of people are sort of disenchanted with basically modern monetary theory. Like, they don't love that we're off the gold standard. They don't love that we can just print money. They don't love runaway fiscal balances. They don't love a centralized authority controlling the supply of this stuff, tracking where it is moving. And Bitcoin really ultimately aims to solve for a lot of those things. Bitcoin is decentralized, meaning there is no like central authority that produces Bitcoin. There's no treasury. There's no central bank associated with any cryptocurrency, but in particular with Bitcoin. If you know, you and I, let's say, wanted to exchange funds, right? Like, we can either do that directly with like cash, which is anonymous, but it's also like linked to treasury, right? It's linked to like a dollar that the government issues. We could do it online through like one of the many apps, but then we're using a third party, right? We're going through like a payment processor. We could do it through like a, you know, like a Western Union type situation, but then there are lots of frictions and there are lots of costs associated with that. Bitcoin is its own thing, right? Like I can move Bitcoin to you, you can move Bitcoin to me. Nobody has to stand in between us. We don't have to exchange it for another currency. It's easy, it's smooth, it's frictionless, it's decentralized. It's highly appealing to people that are, again, kind of wary of the idea that the government is kind of controlling the supply and watching where all this stuff is moving. We also know that Bitcoin, by nature of existing on the blockchain, which is a concept that gets talked about a lot, is very stable. It's very secure, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't mean that it's not prone to user error. Like, you know, you probably read about, I know I've read about these instances of like guys that, you know, had what is now $50 billion worth of crypto, like on an old computer hard drive that they tossed into a landfill like 10 years ago. And now they're like, duh. That's worth a lot more than it was back then. I wish I could get it. And they like pay some guys to dig up the landfill. Like you can still lose your Bitcoin. Yes. You can still screw it up. You can still get scammed. But you can't like counterfeit a Bitcoin. You can't fake a transaction. If I move money, you know, from my account to your account, there's no disputing that. There are no like take backs. And so that stability, that security that's associated with Bitcoin, a lot of that again has to do with its underlying infrastructure that the blockchain is highly appealing.
Yes.
And then finally, I would say the scarcity of Bitcoin is very appealing. And this is where I think a lot of people like to compare it to gold, really, yes. or to any sort of digital precious gold. Metal. Digital gold is like exactly. a term that comes up a lot, right? There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin mined into circulation. That's it. So there's already a cap on how much of this stuff will exist out there. And that's obviously in stark contrast to where we are today, where there is seemingly no end to how much money the government can print and throw into the system. And that scarcity, in theory, breeds value, right? I don't know if I'd necessarily believe that, but that is at least on paper one of the ways that you can approach this story. Now, interestingly enough, and I feel like a lot of people don't fully appreciate this, not all the Bitcoin that will ever exist exists right now. Mm-hmm. We're at around 19 million or so, give or take, Bitcoin. So there are around 2 million Bitcoin still kind of in the hopper waiting to get entered into circulation. And the way that the algorithm works there, the way that Bitcoin is released into circulation, not to be morbid, but we're all going to be dead by the time the last Bitcoin is mined. Yeah. It's going to be sometime in the next 100 years that 21st millionth Bitcoin or 21 millionth Bitcoin actually enters circulation. And so that combination of the asset being decentralized, the combination rather of being decentralized, of it being stable, secure, of it being scarce, all of these things make Bitcoin what it is. It makes Bitcoin, Bitcoin. And that's why this thing has such a almost like religious following. People are really passionate about this stuff, and they see Bitcoin as an answer to a lot of problems.
Yes, I think that makes a lot of sense. Something funny you mentioned, losing the hard drive with your crypto held on it. Mm-hmm. I think now, and something my friends have experienced, is that you get a wallet on your phone and you need to remember a 24-word passkey in order to access your cryptocurrency. And obviously 24 words, tough to remember, and people lose their passwords. And
yeah.
A lot of cryptocurrency maybe being left in that wallet.
And what are you going to do? Like, who are you going to call? Like Mr. Bitcoin? Like, there's like no like hotline to call when you lose your password. It's not like you forget your password at your bank and you call up the bank or you go into the branch. Like, it's interesting you bring that up, right? Because it points to the fact that this security, this decentralization is kind of a double-edged sword.
Yes.
Like you are fully in control of your own destiny.
Yes.
Like it is yours to screw up. And as long as you like don't screw it up, it's great. But if you do screw it up, you have basically no recourse. Something that I think a lot of people have, like your friends, I'm sure, learned the hard way over these past few years.
Something I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about Bitcoin because that is certainly the most mainstream crypto asset out there. But as years have gone on, we've seen more crypto assets come out, some of them a lot more smaller, some of them have or in terms of market cap, some of them have different functions. So can you talk about what else is out there other than cryptocurrency? And can you discuss maybe whether or not those are credible investment opportunities for investors?
So I think after Bitcoin, the one that everybody seems to know about is Ethereum. I think it's actually called Ether. Interestingly enough, I think Ether is the token. Ethereum is the blockchain that it lives on, whereas Bitcoin is the same across both. So Ether is like the next biggest one, right? That's probably like 10 to 15% of market capitalization. And while at the end of the day, it aims to be something very similar to like what Bitcoin aims to be, which is effectively like a digital cash, like some sort of currency that allows for transactions through like a decentralized, secure platform, it goes about it in a slightly different way. Like one of the biggest differences between Ether and Bitcoin is there is no limit to how much Ether will exist. I think they're already like 120 million Ether tokens. They can keep on growing. So that scarcity component isn't really there. The stability, the security component isn't quite there either, because the reason that, or one of the reasons I should say that Bitcoin is like so stable, so secure, is that it is so difficult to create new blocks, so difficult to create new tokens, right? Again, we talk about cryptocurrency being a word that we kind of glaze over. The currency part is sort of self-evident, right? But the crypto part is from cryptography.
Like, yes.
There's a lot of complicated cryptography that goes into building these blockchains. And when you are trying to create new Bitcoin, mine new Bitcoin into existence, you have to solve extraordinarily complex computational problems, which is why people spend a lot of money on like specific hardware. Are ultimately competing with a lot of the stuff that's flowing into artificial intelligence right now with LLM development to get the firepower required to brute force your way into solving like a 26 key crypto hash.
Yes.
Ether does it a little bit differently. That process is called proof of work, right? You do all the work, you show your work, you're rewarded for it. Ether embraces a program called proof of stake, mm-hmm. which is basically, look, I'm going to verify some transaction, earn a little bit of Ether as a result of that verification. I'm going to put up some of the existing Ether that I already have as collateral and basically say that, look, if I'm like doing something silly, goofy, nefarious, I'm trying to like break the blockchain, I'm trying to, you know, wipe out a transaction that actually happened, my collateral gets yanked from me. So it sort of incentivizes people to behave in the correct way. And then by staking stuff up, you're basically returned in proportion to how much you stake some amount of the Ether that ends up getting generated through that transaction. And so it means that this stuff can be created much more quickly, mm-hmm. more easily, but it loses some of the security, the stability. Still, at the end of the day, I would say these two tokens kind of fall into the same camp. Mm-hmm. Then you have like everything else, right? Because now you're talking about what, like 75 to 80% of crypto market cap in just those two tokens,
yep.
maybe even a little bit more than that. There are certain tokens that are meant to facilitate what's referred to as like decentralized finance. So like a really interesting example as sort of a proof of concept is a token referred to as XRP. XRP has been around for a while. Ripple is one of its byproducts. A lot of people are familiar with that name one way or the other. The whole premise behind XRP and its product suite is basically what happens if like, you know, Jack lives here and Brandon, instead of like being over here, is like down in Mexico.
Yes.
And like Jack wants to send money to Brandon across border. And it is complex to do that kind of transaction. Mm-hmm. Like I even experienced that recently. I was in Canada not too long ago, meeting with clients. I went with a couple of Canadian buddies to see the Oilers play in Edmonton, which was sick,
that's
by
awesome.
The way.
Yeah.
Super cool. Very, very nice stadium. And those people are so serious about hockey. Like it's silent the whole way through. But anyway, I put all the tickets on my credit card and went to go like, you know, request cash from everybody. And the Canadian guys couldn't send me money. Like there's no like Zelle, there's no Venmo, there's no like cross-border payment solution, even for individuals. Forget about like massive institutions that are looking to move enormous quantities of money across border. XRP and its products like a Ripple are supposed to be sort of that intermediary. It's that like in-between token where you convert all your dollars into XRP, you move the XRP over, the Ripple over, you convert the Ripple now into pesos, and you have effectively moved currency across borders without all the traditional like frictions costs associated with using like a money transfer, sending a wire through like a Western Union. So there are certain things like decentralized finance where you see some crypto assets as well. Then there are stable coins, which I know we're going to get into it a little bit, so I'm not gonna like blow that up, up front. But then there are also, and this is where I would love to chat with you a little bit more, there are also meme coins.
Yes.
Right? Like a not insignificant component of the crypto landscape is tokens like Dogecoin is probably like one of the original ones
yep.
from at this point God, I mean, maybe almost 10 years ago, probably a little bit less than that. Tokens that just sort of by definition have no value, or the value is like very difficult to assess. And a lot of people kind of pile in and invest in them. And I would imagine that everybody can tell that you're younger than I am because your hairline is a lot better than my hairline is. I'm so jealous of your flow, dude. I would guess that when we think about like who's interacting with these like meme coins or like what I would call almost like nonsense crypto tokens, it's generally speaking going to be younger individuals. Like a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, I was in this room recording another episode of Insights Now with a couple of our colleagues, Katie, Jordan, talking about how millennials, how Gen Z, you know, think about finances, think about investing in crypto is a big part of that. And I know you have like experience sort of on in that front as well, like whatever.
Rough experience. Yeah.
You said you're a student right up front. You already had a caveat out there. Yeah. So like, I'd love to hear a little bit about like you and your friends and how they think about crypto as part of like their investment, you know, sort of portfolio.
Yes, 100%. I think it's very interesting. Definitely, as you mentioned, younger generations more open to investing in the newer asset class, in cryptocurrencies, crypto assets more broadly. If we just put a number to it, from the CFA, let's call it roughly 50% of affluent, that's 100,000 to a million in assets. They have about, or let's call it 50% of them, roughly speaking, 48 have exposure to crypto. And that's more than double what we see for Gen Xers or baby boomers, for example. What I think is most interesting is that if we look at those individuals that have exposure to crypto, a lot of that exposure and the reason they want to be invested in cryptocurrency is due to FOMO. The fear of missing out. And I think in the world of social media, it's so interesting because we all have Instagram and there's this massive blow up of these crypto millionaires. Mm-hmm. They're in Miami, they have nice watches, they're driving nice cars. And I think a lot of individuals, maybe younger individuals, are like, oh, I want to have the same fortune. I want to find an asset before it becomes big and I want to invest in that. And so that could be a sliver of the market or the sliver of the reason that younger individuals want to invest in cryptocurrency. But even if I look at my friends from school, who many of them majored in finance, versus my friends from home who don't necessarily have a finance degree, there's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
Those that understand different asset classes, portfolio theory, for example, are invested in the more let's call it established cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, like Ether, for example, that have this utility. They understand the assets and it's a part of their portfolio construction process. Whereas my friends from home, no shade to them at all, but they may be more in the, I want to find something before it gets big and get pretty rich.
Yeah.
Right. So for,
and that happens.
It does.
Like not often. And that's not investing advice.
Exactly.
Like, that does happen every once in a while. You read about people that just blow up because they hit the lottery. Aside.
Exactly. It does happen. But I think it's important to level set. It's like, it's not going to happen to everyone. As you see on Instagram,
probably not to you. And not
probably not. No, I know. Something that, for example, that we were all invested in was PiCoin. You mentioned how difficult it is to actually mine Bitcoin. You need a lot of intense hardware. The whole premise of PiCoin, I'm not going to speak to its merits, was that you can mine it from your phone. And there was this sort of social network effect where the community of pioneers would eventually,
that's great branding,
would eventually transact in this PiCoin and create a sort of marketplace. So again, there is utility there. Is it credible? Is it not? Like, who knows?
Yeah.
But for my friends who, again, don't necessarily understand the portfolio theory, it was an opportunity to try to get in on something early and make a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I think that's how some people in the younger generations are approaching the asset class, but there certainly is merit to having it as a part of a portfolio as well.
Yeah.
Looking for industry-leading insights on markets and the economy? Our Guide to the Markets illustrates a comprehensive array of market and economic histories, trends, and statistics through clear charts and graphs. For more information on the guide, visit our website at jpmorgan.com/GTM.
And if we zoom out, anything in which you see massive price appreciation, this kind of mentality of I'm going to get rich, I'm going to get rich quick, shortly after follows some sort of regulation for the market, right? And we've seen some pretty massive shifts in regulation from the crypto market. For example, in the US, we have the Genius Act that passed that relates to stable coins. We have the Clarity Act as well. That's also, I believe, ongoing through Congress. So love to hear a little bit about that from your perspective and how you view the changes we've seen to the regulatory landscape for the crypto market more broadly and whether or not that's changed the thesis for the asset class.
Yeah, I think it's sort of the next natural step in the conversation is to talk about the increased legitimacy of cryptocurrency, or at least the perception of legitimacy of cryptocurrency as an asset. And by the way, it's apropos to nothing. It's funny you're talking about like these Miami crypto bros. So he's like thinking about myself. I'd be such a terrible crypto bro. It's like my wrists are too small to support those like giant watches.
Yeah, they got like six, like, seven Rolex.
It would never work, dude. I could never do it. Anyway, when I think about the sort of increased legitimacy of cryptocurrency, there are a few things that I think come to mind. There are serious futures exchanges out there, including the Chicago Board of Trade, that actually host Bitcoin futures.
Yep.
That wouldn't exist if there wasn't real institutional interest in the space.
Yep.
So like there are big institutional players. It's not just like your
my friends.
Exactly. Yes. That invested in the crypto world. And by the way, like my best friend from college is like a huge crypto guy. So like I get it.
Yes.
You're not alone in that camp. We also have, of course, very high-profile launches last year of cryptocurrency ETFs.
Yes.
Where before, if you wanted to own this thing, you could only do it through a crypto wallet, which is like where you lose your password and you never get it back
words.
Again.
Yeah,
exactly.
A lot of words.
Good luck.
Yep.
Or you do it through like a trust, which doesn't always necessarily track the price. Now you can essentially buy this thing directly. It's like buying a gold ETF, but instead of gold, it's Bitcoin. Or I think they just launched one for Ether not too long ago. That's another sign of increased legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, and this is where the regulatory conversation comes into play, and this is what you mentioned yourself, Brandon, is like what's going on with legislation in the United States, particularly when we consider that like this current administration is very crypto friendly.
Yes.
And I would say probably the most important single news item for the crypto universe, and I think the only piece of legislation in the United States focused on digital tokens ever passed, mm-hmm. was last year's Genius Act. Genius is, of course, an acronym like all other, you know, seemingly pieces of legislation.
Yep.
I have no idea what it stands for, but it's all caps.
Yep.
It's an acronym. And what was important about the Genius Act is that it laid out very clear guidelines, like an institutionalized regulatory framework for stablecoins.
Yes.
Now, a stablecoin has existed for a very long time.
What does that say?
Like, stablecoins have been around for a lot longer than, like, just the Genius Act came around.
Yes.
And the idea of a stablecoin is that its value is supposed to be stable.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to track the value of something else that's much more widely used, usually the dollar, right? But up until the Genius Act got passed last year, this area was kind of the Wild West. Genius Act put some real guardrails around the stablecoin conversation. It establishes very clear KYC frameworks, or know your client frameworks, to help to prevent money laundering, which is always going to be one of the biggest concerns around, like, you know, sort of anonymized digital assets. It also sets very clear parameters for what collateral looks like in this stuff. You know, we live in a world of fractional banking reserves where a bank can take in $10 and turn around and lend $100 and nobody seems to care. I mean, that's how modern finance works. But for every stable coin that exists, it has to be backed up one for one, dollar for dollar, with an actual dollar denominated high quality asset. That could be a dollar itself that's deposited in the Federal Reserve branch. It could be a repo agreement with the Fed. It can be, I believe, a 90-day or less ultra short duration treasury bond.
Mm-hmm.
Those three things will serve as collateral. And once you did this stuff, right, once you introduced a regulatory framework, eliminated some of the pain points around money laundering, once you established like a clear collateral regime to make sure that people weren't worried about like breaking the buck, so to speak, by moving into stable coins, you kind of opened the floodgates for stable coins to become a much, much more legitimate part of modern day finance.
Yep.
And the U.S. in this case is very interesting because it really does have first mover advantage. Not many other countries around the world have passed such comprehensive legislation. And interestingly, when you look at like the currencies that stable coins are typically denominated in, the U.S. dollar is by far in a way the biggest one, because in Europe, for example, stable coins exist. You can have like a digital euro, but the only collateral that you can have to back up that digital euro is a physical euro deposited in a bank.
Okay.
Like not overnight paper, not repo agreements. The flexibility that we have in the U.S. doesn't really exist in other regions. The digital dollar has kind of taken off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the digital dollar is, of course, centralized, right?
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, even though like the stable coin will be created by like an entity, what it's backed up by will be created by a central authority in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's also definitionally not scarce because, again, it's tied to the money supply in the states and it has nothing, no control over that.
Yep.
But it is digital. and it is safe and it is secure and it benefits from all those things that people, normal people, typically look to when they look to blockchain infrastructure, right? You can move money almost instantaneously. You can do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365. There are no holidays, no weekends. There's no like 9-to-5 workday. Like, you want your money, you can move it quickly. The cost of moving it as a result of all these things is a whole lot lower. I'm really excited about sort of the next chapter of like modern finance because of this stablecoin revolution.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, the ultimate result of all this is that blockchain, again, this infrastructure that we've been talking about quite a bit, truly becomes a marketplace. Mm-hmm. Like right now, most people trade either like tokens themselves or like stupid stuff. Like, you know, when you think of like an NFT, you think of like monkey cigar, right?
Yeah.
Like the monkey with the sunglasses. Like that's what everybody thinks of.
Yep.
Anything can be tokenized. Mm-hmm. Like I could, you know, your parents could tokenize the deed to their house and like trade it on the blockchain.
Yes.
But they would never do that because if you want to buy or sell that tokenized asset, you have to do it with an extraordinarily volatile crypto token.
Yes.
You know, like your parents sell their house to me. Let's say your parents sell their house to me for $1 million. I pay them $1 million in Bitcoin. Tomorrow it could be worth $1.5 million.
Yeah.
It could also be worth $500,000.
Yep.
Nobody wants to engage in that kind of currency risk.
Yes.
But by removing the currency risk, which is what you do by transacting in stable coins, now you get all the benefits of like a 24/7 digital marketplace with minimal frictions without any of the pains that had historically been associated with transacting in more typical crypto tokens. So there's a trade-off, right? But I think for most people, stable coins kind of feel like the future.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So just so make sure I'm clear and that the viewers understand it. Stablecoin, the whole purpose is in the name, to keep a stable value. It's for fast and secure payment and settlement. Whereas if we think about traditional cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, for example, that is a decentralized store of value, but also a diversifier or a risk asset that can appreciate. That's the best way to understand
it. I think that's a great way to think about it.
So
it can appreciate.
Can appreciate.
Because it will appreciate.
Yes, that is true. Good point. So I guess for investors, and always think about this stablecoin revolution, it obviously has a ton of utility. Why not just hold deposits in stablecoin in general? Or what are some of the risks associated with the stablecoin more broadly?
Risk, I don't know if is the right word,
yeah.
but I have a hard time imagining that stablecoins, at least as they stand right now, will fully replace things like deposits in banks or even things like certificates of deposit, money market fund, like short-term cash-like instruments. Because at least the way that things are worded right now through the Genius Act, stablecoin providers are not allowed to pay interest. Now, there are like creative ways to rebrand interest and get that money flowing. It can certainly happen. I'm sure that it will.
Yes.
But you right now, as things stand, cannot get paid interest directly on the stable coins that you own. Very, very different, obviously, than a money market fund, than a than a CD, even than like a savings account, where you are getting essentially compensated for your illiquidity, for locking up your money with this institution. The other kind of problem with a like digital dollar, right, is that it functions much more like a debit card than it does like a credit card.
Understood.
If they're using it online. You know, you've had like digital currency for a while in the form of like being able to, you know, enter your credit card information on Amazon or whatever. Like, you've been able to buy things online forever. But there is no such thing as credit within the stablecoin universe. Like, what would that even look like conceptually? It doesn't make a lot of sense.
And
credit is like just such an integral, like underlying or underpinning component of modern finance that you would have to figure out how to solve for that, whatever solving for that may end up looking like, before this thing ultimately ends up replacing like the credit card payment processors of the world. So it's interesting for very specific cases. It is not going to like fully replace our modern monetary system. It's certainly not overnight, perhaps not ever.
Understood. And then I guess final question, we'll finish off here. Not the safe haven asset, but still an important consideration in the asset allocation process.
Yep.
How do you think investors should consider right-sizing the allocations and portfolios if they do decide that exposure is right for them?
Yeah. So that's a big one, right? Is you got to figure out if it's right for you.
Yes.
And we could clearly, I think we've already talked too long. We could talk for hours about this stuff.
Yes.
I've given up on trying to tell people not to own this stuff, right?
It has to be the most asked question.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
MIQs when
everybody wants to know. And I've just like, I've given up trying to say don't on it. So I've like switched tact. And the tact now is like own own whatever you want. Like, I would personally not advocate more than like 5% of your net worth at a maximum, sort of similar to what we would advocate in gold, frankly. But almost treat it like you're going to Vegas. You know, like you're putting it all on black at the roulette table. If it hits, you become fabulously wealthy and you're everybody's best friend. And if it doesn't, then like, you knew what you were signing up for. And I think if you have that mentality that you're only staking what you're willing to lose, then you can, you know, sort of get a horse in the race, so to speak. You can start paying attention to this stuff, which I think pretty clearly is very interesting. Like, you may not like it, but it's super interesting. And it's clearly not going anywhere anytime soon, especially not with all the legislation, the regulatory push, the increased legitimization that we were talking about earlier. And if that's how, like, you can, you know, get invested, you know, not directly, but like philosophically invested in the concept of crypto, then fine, you know, go for it. But I wouldn't sell out of all your equities and move them all into PiCoin. That is, I hope I didn't burst anybody's bubble there. But no, I that is not what I would do, I think, when we think about a serious allocation in the future.
That sounds good. Like you said, don't invest what you aren't prepared to lose.
Big time.
But again, thanks for joining me. I think we could have had a conversation that lasted hours.
And
I think not only is it an important opportunity for investors to consider in portfolios, but there's also a ton of utility behind the crypto space as well. So thank you for diving a little bit deeper into that. And we want to thank you for joining us as well. I'm walking away with a much deeper understanding of the crypto market. And to our listeners, we hope that you can say the same. As always, thank you for tuning in. We have so many more great conversations on the way. So stay tuned for the next episode of JP Morgan Asset Management's Insights Now. Until then, stay safe and take care.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.